I'm beginning to understand what we're doing.
I think that what we're talking about is the ethical responsibility of the artist. If I would put a title to these four lectures, I think I would end up with that title, The Ethical Responsibility of the Artist. I think you are kind in realizing that some of these ideas are growing as I speak, and therefore they're not finished. They're coming to you in broad strokes, and my hope, besides your kindness for allowing me to think out loud in front of you, is that you will take this ball and run. That some of the thoughts that are not altogether formed, you can continue to work on hereafter, and you can continue to shape and to form them yourself. Second reason why I'm a bit nervous, you'll notice that of the four obediences that I've been talking about and that I have once again put on the board, one obedience I did not put on the board was an obedience to theme or meaning. And that's not an accidental lacuna. I didn't overlook that. It was very conscious. It seems to me, at any rate, when I write a poem or a story or a novel, that I will make certain decisions early on, which I will tell you about with regard to Potter, but that what I don't do thereafter is so furiously obey some of those early decisions for theme or meaning that I end up writing a sermon instead of a fiction, a story, a poem. In other words, I'm careful, or it's dangerous. It gets dangerous if what we want to do is allegorize. If I have a meaning, I might as well just tell you the meaning straight out. Why do I put it in a story and make you work to try to interpret it? Therefore, it seems to me I will make certain decisions early on. I will say, here is an important thing to consider in an artistic form. But having said that, and having made the proper preparations underneath these four areas of obedience, and then beginning the artistic work itself, the work begins to take on its own life. And it is as it were, that I and the work begin to stand in relationship to one another. And I have to allow that work its own direction. It becomes a kind of a living thing. If I start to bring in specific author's message at any point, I may hurt the life which is aborning within my hands. Does that make sense? Nevertheless, I still must be committed to the four obediences so that what is aborning is well-born and not poorly born. This makes me a bit nervous to talk about Potter then, because to talk about it may restrict it or kill it for some of you. You may have gone in directions that I didn't know about or intend. That's supposed to happen, I think, with the work of art. The only thing I would request when you go in those directions is that you don't impose upon this piece of art your prejudices, your prejudgments, that you allow it to work with you. I've seen people think they're interpreting something when all they're doing is taking a single passage that happened to fit some notion that they had, and then they're twisting and distorting everything else in that art. We do this with the Bible too, in order to make it fit some pattern we already had in our mind. That's the only thing I would request. Otherwise, you may go in directions that I don't know. You will establish a relationship also with this piece of art. For me now, as I will do tonight, to talk a little bit about the forces that went into the making of this and how they fall underneath these four obediences is a bit to objectify a living thing. It's a bit like gossip. I'm gossiping about someone who isn't here to defend themselves. And so I may be giving you opinions about this work that would be a little unrealistic for you. I may make it wooden, you see. Hereafter you'll say, oh, well, I can't think this about Potter because Walt didn't mean that when Walt wrote it. Don't worry about that. But I would like to show you the other side of the wall. That's what I will do a little bit tonight, and a little bit on how I involved myself in trying to obey some of those things as I wrote it. This becomes the example. I don't know that there'll be any stories then tonight. I hope that's okay. Maybe that's the third reason I wrote it. It's nice just to give you stories and then let you walk away with it. Here I'm going to pick the poor thing apart a little bit. And then I hope that I will leave time for discussion too, that you may have some questions. And I'll do my best to answer them. But I'll tell you what, if your questions are, if they become, did you mean this, dear author, dear artist, did you mean this? I may say, well, maybe. I don't know. An awful lot happens. one more time for those of you who are not here, and because it keeps changing a tad for those of you who were here, these are the four obediences. Well, first, I'm calling commitment to the craft, and I'm breaking that into three. That means I need to know as much as possible the whole history of literature, my craft, and read and read and read and understand what went on before. I should know Dante. You'll see something of this when I talk about Potter. It's a children's story, but it requires an adult to write it. Number two, commitment to the craft means that I should establish some kind of living community with other people who are also committed to my craft, so I understand what's going on, so that we support one another, or argue with one another, bless one another. I'll speak something about that. Number three, certainly I should have learned by long apprenticeship, the conventions and the technique of my particular craft. Two, the second, this is going on the take two, and that's why I'm reading it. The second major obedience that I recognize is the accurate observation of reality. Somebody came up to me and asked me about that after the first day when I spoke with them. Where are you? Nada's husband. There you are. And so I shaped it a little bit more, and I gave it an anagram. It is SEW, S-E-W. This is how you can remember it. This is not necessarily the proper order, but accurate observation of reality, I suggest, means, number one, a studying of the authorities. Anybody who has seriously labored or studied in the area where this particular work of art is going, or, you know, some of the, I don't mean necessarily now literary people, with regard to Potter, it means, for example, that I should have read and did Kubler-Ross. This fits very much with Mary Carlson's lecture this afternoon. E-S-E-E is personal experience, that I be absolutely honest. This is another reason that makes me nervous. In every story I write, there are some very, now I don't mean this in just a nice way, I mean this in a practical way. There's some very tender things. Something of my history and my past appears in there, but they're so nicely obscured and cloaked that if you step on them, you don't know it. Tonight I will reveal some of that, and it's a little bit like, I don't want you to hurt my private parts. Number three, or the third underneath accurate observation of reality, is an empathetic watching, W, watch. Empathetic watching of other people. Very important. That I dwell within you as I watch you. That I learn the signals and the signs so much of who you are. Let me say this. I know this is some of your record. You are so kind. I should have, somewhere in my childhood, and this did happen, this is why artists are sometimes reclusive and separated and quiet. I should have learned the gestures and the motions of my own face, how my face moves when I feel sad, the shape my face takes when I'm quizzical or happy, so that when those very same gestures appear in your face, I read you and I enter into you. And that becomes such a kind of an intimate connection that sometimes, when I was young, I would see, it still happens to me, I will see somebody walk by with a certain cast of shoulder, and they will look lonely, and I will instantly feel lonely with them, immediately. That kind of watching, that's just a single example. Third is the love of the audience. Those who will respond to your art, who will experience this room, womb, household in which you ask them to dwell. And I just put a bunch of adjectives here. That love requires that the work be not destructive, divisive, demonic, enslaving, killing. Those are very carefully chosen, but I could add so many more. Destructive of the people, divisive people from people, demonic, I mean that, enslaving, that people having read this would be, or other people having read it would enslave somebody, or somehow killing of the spirit. This makes me nervous too, because I very much am aware of my sinfulness. And I know that my sinfulness must also creep into my writing sometimes. And so I would not that you be enslaved by what I have written, but I fear that sometime you might be, and then I'm scared I might find out about it. But rather, it should be good, revealing, redeeming. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's sweet and sentimental and all that kind of stuff. A good, redeeming, revealing dwelling place. And finally, the faithfulness to God, I divide it into three. It means an awareness. Obedience always requires knowledge. An awareness of scripture or holiness, my call, the code of God, what God would require. And then the story, particularly for me as a writer, very important that I have dwelt within and lived with, the story of God's strong, persistent labor for the redemption of the whole race of humanity. It also means that I stand in relationship to the Word made flesh, that there is a particulate relationship between me and the Christ, and not just a cloudy one, but an intimate one, not just an intellectual, doctrinal one, but a close one. And finally, and I say this for all artists, faithfulness to God, I think, also means being open to what I'm calling here the astonishing wind of the Spirit. This, I think, almost as much as anything else, is the secret cavern out of which comes my creativity. That things happen as you write, as you obey, as you labor to obey, things surprise you on the page. And you say, oh, that is so beautiful. Where did that come from? That doesn't happen often. I wish it happened more. Most often I know exactly what I'm doing. But every once in a while, the words are just so beautiful. And that comes from the Spirit. And that's where this humility is required. All right, Potter, and some background. Although this is going to seem unrelated to you, I think it's very related. Community, let me start here. Commitment to the craft and community in the present. Some of you may have heard, this isn't exactly a story, it's a memorial. And you may have read it, because I wrote it up once, and I put it in one of the Lutheran columns. I spoke about a woman whom I named Emily Dichter. That's not her real name. I'll tell you the real name. I chose that name because I took Emily from Emily Dickinson, and Dichter, which means German?
Poet.
Poet, yeah. And I couldn't ask her if it was all right to use her name because she has died. Her name is Clara Schreiber. You remember this, Nita? Yeah. Well, this is part of what makes a writer, and it is so important that these things happen. When they happen, they are the grace of God. I was just telling Miriam Stunkel out there, and so I thought I'd tell you. My mother, when I wrote her a letter in graduate school, and I said, I think I'd like to be a writer. It was a very serious letter where I was kind of revealing something that I feign hope wouldn't ever happen, but I wished it would. I said, I want to be a writer. And my mother wrote back, wonderful letter, full of practical sense. My mother, she is the reason I'm a poet, but she doesn't quite understand all these regions of poetry or what forces drive people to do such silly things. My mother wrote back and said, maybe I shouldn't tell you what my mother said. Spirit sweeps the place. She said, greeting cards. She said, write greeting cards. She said, there's money in greeting cards. My parents approve much of what I do. I think they are a bit bemused that I do it. I think they feel sometimes uncertain if they fully understand what I'm doing, but they praise me. On the other hand, there is Clara Schreiber, and I think this is required. Potter comes out of this, but as it were, out of community. When I first began as a very young pastor at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, there was an elderly lady reaching her 90s, was very short, and I think her shortness is partly because of how stooped she was, who came to church leaning on her daughter's arm, who was also an elderly woman, then too, I think in her 60s, her name was Ruth. So I didn't know her very well, but I knew that she was there. And I received an invitation from her to honor her with my presence, which sounded marvelous to me, that I would honor anybody with my presence. It was a very formal invitation. Honor her with my presence for luncheon at her house, Emily Schreiber, Clara Schreiber, it was. And I didn't know why she wanted me to come to her house. I was the assistant pastor, and those often work with youth, which is the most significant thing to do in a parish, but not all the people in the parish know that. And so you're not always praised for that kind of a labor that works with youth. And I was responsible for education there, which is a significant thing in a parish, but not all the people in the parish know that, which is why you sometimes have meetings with three people and you. So I wasn't sure why she invited me, but I remember that I went to her house, and because of the formality of the invitation, I thought it would be like a mansion.
or Tudor house or something like that. But I came and it was a very small cottage-like house, just a four-room bungalow type house. And I rang the doorbell and her daughter welcomed me in and then led me back into the kitchen through the one room into the kitchen, which was immediately on the other side of the other room, and that was the whole length of the house. It was so small. And there sat Clara Schreiber at the table with a very nice meal set on the table, and she was crouched down. She had a cane that she always held, and she was so much like a bird. Her hands were like claws, like bird claws, and she looked up, and she had thick glasses. And she welcomed me very, very formally. She welcomed Walter Blumman and asked me to sit down, introduced me to her daughter, and said, "This is my amanuensis." It's the kind of language that she used. It was very formal. Amanuensis means that her daughter did the reading for her and did the writing for her and the filing and communications and all that kind of stuff. And Ruth nodded and then began the service. And we ate in a kind of a formal silence. And then Clara said, "There are three reasons why I invited you here." The first, she said, is to renew old acquaintances. She said, "I knew your grandfather. My grandfather is also named Walter. My father is named Walter." She had no problem. Annoying boy was. She said that we were together in Lombard, Illinois. He was the pastor of the Lutheran parish there. And she said, "My husband was the principal of the school, this Missouri Synod School." And she said, "I wanted to see how the generations were getting on." Second, she said, and here is where I began to tingle. She said, "And I would like to offer myself to you as your mentor." She said, "I would be your mentor." She said, "I too am an author." Which was marvelous to me on two counts. I could hardly answer her. First of all, I didn't know she was an author, and it overwhelmed me that I was sitting in the presence of another author. Nobody had ever invited me into their presence as an author and offered such a valuable thing as mentor. She said, "I have written a book." She said it was a book on Catherine Luther, published by Muhlenberg. Marvelous thing. The other thing that took my breath away is that she would know I wrote. I felt a bit ashamed. I felt a bit embarrassed taking time from important things like the youth and education at Redeemer Lutheran Church to hunch over a typewriter and to be writing late at night or early in the morning, times when people couldn't see me. You know, we artists, we stow away these things. We feel faintly embarrassed. And part of the story of Clara Schreiber will say why we feel a little bit embarrassed, particularly in our Lutheran heritage. The third thing that she said is, "And I invited you here, now listen to these words, so that you should never dance in the dark." And I didn't understand that. She gave me a few days to decide whether or not she would be my mentor. She gave me a book, I remember. It was a book on Mozart that I should read. It was a biography of Mozart. And I took it, and I accepted. She became my mentor. And over a period of time, I began to hear Clara Schreiber's story, which I offer to you. In Lombard, Illinois, she was a young woman who was doing that which other people didn't approve of. She was writing. She was writing and had written ever since she was a child. This was something which was a force inside of her and something she didn't choose. And she was embarrassed by it, but she couldn't help it. She had to write. Now you have to understand, or perhaps you do understand, and maybe you remember, this is back in the 1920s and the 1930s, what writing meant. And what writing women meant. It was a vanity, okay? You could write sermons, you could write letters, you could write cards, you could write essays in school, but to write fiction or to write poetry really didn't have a place within that community because they didn't know what utilitarian value it fulfilled and how did it praise God. And besides that, she was a woman with several children, she should be raising her children. And besides that, her husband was the principal, Teacher Schreiber they called him, Teacher Schreiber. What would that do to Teacher Schreiber's profession if people found out that his wife was involved in this vain, faintly hysterical thing, writing as though it was compulsive? My father told me that my aunt just left the society and moved to other places because her tendencies were not very well accepted within that particular community. And while she was there at Lombard, Illinois,
while her husband went off to work, and all people praised Teacher Schreiber, and while her children went off to school, and they were all praised because they were doing important and utilitarian things, she hunched in the dining room and she began to write a book. And she told me of that. She said that she did the research, she did the work, and she began to write in longhand this book, page after page after page. She began to grow her right-hand side, and she told nobody. Because this was a hysterical, this was a vanity, this was vain. I think that she, I don't think she felt guilty. I don't think so. I just think she was careful. Because of what she became, I think that she survived guilt. But she wrote that book. I don't know if Teacher Schreiber knew or not. Perhaps he did. I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know what kind of relationship they had. She told me that the day came when she was done. She finished her book, and she wrapped it up. She tied it in a ribbon. Well, she, this is her experience. She didn't know. You tie a manuscript in a ribbon, and she sent it to the Muhlenberg Press. And then she held her breath for a month, and 2 months, and 3 months. And then she said the letter came. It was just a slim little letter with a single page on the inside. And she didn't show anybody. She waited until Teacher Schreiber had gone to work, and the children were all off, and she took it into the dining room, and she slipped it open. And she pulled out a single page. And it said, dear, it might as well have said, dear Teacher Schreiber's wife. It said, dear Mrs. Clara Schreiber, congratulations. We have decided to publish your book on Catherine. Clara Schreiber told me that when she opened up that letter and read it, she was so full of joy. She said, right there in the middle of the living room, she put her hands on top of her head so it wouldn't blow off. And she started spinning and spinning in the living room so that her skirts popped out like this, and she laughed and she danced and she danced and she danced for joy that it should, this would come to such fruit. But she said that before she danced, she drew the curtains. So that no patience. And she said to me, I would be your mentor. And I have called you here so that you would never have to dance in the dark. To me, this woman is a marvelous woman. It is that's the only book she ever wrote, and yet she maintained, in spite of the society, she maintained the identity of an author and became a very formal author. She lived in a small bungalow at the end of her life and did not blame, which really blows my mind, did not live in bitterness and grinding blame, but survived holy and sweet and graceful and forgiving and so perceptive that she picked me out of that congregation and recognized the thing that I was doing, the silly, hysterical, vain thing that I was doing, and blessed it with her presence. And I remember that I spoke to Ruth once and I said something about how carefully and watchfully the woman saw me and how well she saw me. And Ruth said, well, she's almost blind. Oh, thank you for listening to that. That's more space probably than I should give. No, it isn't. I say that a good deal of my writing comes out of the establishment of those relationships that protect and console and argue and fight, but all within this grand kingdom where we agree that certain things are right and that there is a craft that we have to learn. And this is the sort of thing that I continue to seek even now today. There isn't a large community. Let me just please stick, for all the people who will hear this tape hereafter, stick one comment in. And then for all of you who are artists, stand behind me as I make this comment. For God's sake, let the church not blame us anymore. I remember that when I went through school, what I did was mostly tolerated. It was better than what Clara had. But and people smiled, and in a certain spiritual way, they patted me on the head for what I did. But I would like to see the church go back to what the church was when it was Roman Catholic and when it was the 16th century and the 15th and the 17th, where the artists were in some respect respected. I would like to see that. I would like to see congregations find artists and mentor them. Find the Clara Schreibers and praise them and then ask them to go find artists and mentor them and pay them. Pay them some money. And then now I'm way off the top. All right. But I think that's significant. Whoever you are as an artist, I think this present Participation in the community is necessary. Plus history. Let me show you some of the history that exists. I'm going to flip now to Potter and speak in some specific vein. Let me pop down here to accurate observation of reality, just to give you what was in my mind when I started writing this book. It occurred to me, I was invited to write this, by the way. David C. Cook said, we have this series and so forth and so on, and we would like you to write a book for it. And so here was an opportunity. It occurred to me that again and again in the grieving process, I don't see a whole element of our society. I don't see them well invited and participatory, and that is the children among us. In some places, the children are very much a part of, but in other places, and very often, it seems to me that the adults think that they are preserving children from difficult emotions and from sorrow and from grief just by sort of excising the children from the whole process of grief. The immediate children of a family will often appear at a funeral, but they will often also be shunted to another house, somebody else watches over them, people put smiles on, say false things, the children immediately sense as false about what happened to mother or what happened to grandma or what happened to aunt, uncle, friend, so forth and so on. And the children know that. In my ministry, I was so often aware that when the funeral came, there were many white heads and there were also many adults who were tangentially related to the person who had died. But many of the children who had known that person were not there. And so they weren't part of this entire communal process that consoles or directs or shapes grief. And so this is what was in my mind at the beginning. This is not what, therefore, I followed all the way through. I mean, theme and meaning, as I said here at the beginning of the lecture. But it seemed to me that I wanted to invite the children and to acknowledge and honor what I thought also was the process of grieving that went on for them as well. And so I looked backward, and this is why I say I'm going to drop here to number two. I looked backward to some of my own experience. And so you may imagine that Potter involves some of my own experience. There was a boy. I lived in 619 Reeves Drive, Grand Forks, North Dakota. And there was a friend of mine who, yes, was drowned in the Red River. And it was in spring, and it was when the river was high and really an angry thing. Although I didn't sense that anger until the child died. And yes, there was a moment when my father said to my mother that image, which for me became the image of death thereafter. And that's why I put it in the book, because the child will understand if you're talking up here and not honest with reality. My father said to my mother, the reason that the boy hadn't surfaced was because a twig had run through his nostril, and the twig had held him on the bottom. So on, these things were in my mind at the very beginning. So was the Oriole, the Baltimore Oriole. They are in Grand Forks. I know they are because I caught one once. I don't remember how. I do remember that I held the bird in my hand. This is an adult hand you're looking at, so reduce it to a child's hand. I was in Grand Forks grades 3 and 4, so it couldn't have been past grade 4. And it was no earlier than grade 3. In our backyard, I picked up a beautiful Baltimore Oriole, held it in my hand, and I had those sensations that I described in the book. This is the accurate observation, this is the E, this is the personal experience, that the neck felt to me so dangerously thin. It made me nervous how thin his neck was. It was a living bird, it wasn't a dead one. Oh, I see. Connection. That's really all right. If I can do what I'm doing here, y'all can do that. But then the second feeling that shot through me as I held that bird is I felt extremely sad, and I was very angry at Adam. I wanted so badly to talk to that bird, and I wanted to know what it was thinking. And somehow in my Sunday school training, I had picked up the notion that because of sin, we were separated, the animals and we human beings were separated, and what used to be sweet communication was now broken between us. And so I was mad at Adam, and that was true as well. Seems to me there. Well, and then early on, the other thing that I wanted to do was not just to deal with grief alone, I wanted to deal with resurrection. I wanted to come to some kind of good conclusion of that grief. Now, this begins to get very, very complicated. So let me say this first. It was clear in my mind that I wanted to take this very old legend, which predates Christianity, but which the early Christian church used maybe you know this, and here I was, as it were, now we're back up to the craft and history. I was bowing to my precursors, my Christian precursors, who wanted in some way to make the secular world understand what they meant by resurrection. And so they took what was in effect a pagan mythological figure, the phoenix. And they used it in those early sermons within the first 150 years of the Christian church. They used the phoenix as an example of the resurrection, and what it means. They would tell that story. And in those days, you understand, they thought phoenixes really existed. And so they used the phoenix to give some form, shape, excitement, narrative power to the whole issue. You see, in those days, there's so much to tell you. In those days, they read the earth as we read books. They would read the way animals walked. They would read what they would call natural history to see the handwriting of God. And then they would understand God's mind the deeper. And they found even mercy in creation, which is a difficult thing for us to do today, ever since Newton. But they found grace, and they found resurrection. You know how so often the image for mercy is the pelican? That's because a pelican often has a red dot at the end of its beak. And the story was told in those days that the reason that red dot was there is because the mother pelican, when there was no food to give her children, would pierce her own breast until she bled, and then feed the blood to her children, which makes us perhaps shiver a little bit, but it became for them the most wonderful image of sacrificial love. And so often in the churches, you look in the stained glass windows, you may see the phoenix rising from the fire, and you may see the pelican with the red dot on the beak. It's telling the story, and it's telling it according to natural history. So I made the choice. Number two, number one, grief in my own experience. Number two, that I would use the ancient story that had the blessing of centuries upon it. That's part of it. This is part of me bowing down. It's part of humility. That I wouldn't try to make up my own, but I would use what the church had used over and over again, which to me meant that the whole phoenix legend would carry much more power than I even understood. That my soul does not encompass all that legend. And then the third thing that I knew early on is that, but nevertheless, I didn't want to make that heaven is my home just a sort of a soppy, sweet, sentimental unreality. Because heaven is your home, don't feel sad, child. And I wanted the whole concept of resurrection then not just to turn our attention to the other world. That's happened too much. That's where, you know, we've seen enslavement happen, where religion comes along and it says, you have a sorry lot, woman, but think about heaven. Heaven will be all right. Or we say to the slaves, you know, it's bad here, it's okay, but wait till the chariot comes and picks you up. Well, and besides all that, many of us who grieve hardly recognize that we are dying. That was on my mind. That's what grief is. It is dying. We are dying. Because that relationship, which was life between me and the person who physically died, has sundered. It is broken. I lived my life there. Something of my life is foreshortened. I'm dying. Resurrection for me, who dies in this world, who is the griever, is somehow or other this very difficult process, this mourning process of returning to the difficult life. What was called this afternoon acceptance. And so, that was the third thing. Somehow or other, there would have to be that return in there. And so, I began to write the story. It went through many, many revisions. But then, these are some of the conventions and some of the history of my craft that I was very watchful of. Let me give you some examples. I'm looking here at page 25 of the book Potter Itself. I will read you. What I do, what I just love to do, is leave Easter eggs in the story, which is to say that there are forces going on underneath that I'm aware of because I'm drawing upon history, and every once in a while I'll pop the force up to visible level where you can find it. It's like a scavenger hunt or something. Here's a little sign. Take hold of it and understand how much is shaping this story underneath because I'm obeying. Here is one of those Easter eggs on page 25, and I will test you all and see if... Is it page 25? Well, should be. That's what it says right there, page 25. I want to be able to find it right away. It's at the beginning of the sequence of the crisis. That
here it is, page 28. Can't read my writing. I'm going to read you the first paragraph.
This is really self-indulgent to show this stuff to you. I almost never do this. This is wonderful.
In the days when Potter was a boy and sick, the doctors did not have penicillins for healing, no shots to shoot the fever down. Therefore, children had to fight fevers with the strength of their own small bodies, and often no one knew who'd be the stronger, the boy or the fever. If the boy, then the fever went away, but if the fever, then they both departed to the everlasting cold, zero at the bone. Does anybody know where zero at the bone comes from? If you do, shout it out.
Emily Dickinson.
Hey, who said that?
Poet among us.
Emily Dickinson. That's my Easter egg to you. This is also, I tell you that Schreiber, Claire Schreiber, is my community. You must know that all whom I have read become my community as well. And I draw upon that, and I draw upon it even more than I am aware. So this is a bit of a lie to you. I'm defrauding you just a little bit. Which is to say that there's an instinctive process going on here, and then I become aware of this process. And I'm not so smart as I'm making myself sound. This is the poem that it comes from. I'm going to read it to you, and then you watch how it underlines much of what happens in the book I read you yesterday. It starts off, "A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides, as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet. It opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought, a whiplash unbraiding in the sun, then stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I know, and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone." That's where that comes from. The arrow fellow in the grass is what?
It's
a snake, it's a serpent. But you see, as she uses it in this poem, that serpent becomes a symbol for so much else, huh? So much else. I think that she's tracking all the way backward to this serpent in the garden, and yet she brings it right down to the common day where she calls herself a boy and walks through the grass, and there that thing is. And I've had that very same experience. Yes, I was just walking with my friend Mike Carson the other week. We were in the woods, and I saw this braid, and it really was. I understand what she was talking about. There was a long serpent right across a snake, across our path, and somehow or other it looked as though someone had taken a spring and pulled it out like that. It still had the corkscrew shape to it. Now look! Look how water, no, look how the river plays a role, both. Water and the river plays a role throughout this story. And how that rides beneath the surface and begins to shape the story. Part of this was consciously done, and then part of it just takes the life of its own. The river in here strikes me as a dangerous thing. It's a killer. It kills a boy. It killed Jonathan. It rose up, and because it was blocked at its own head, remember that? That just seemed a horrible thing to me. And so you have this sense of an evil water. And if you remember the story, those of you who heard it last night, you know that river is both at the beginning referred to and at the end. When Potter comes flying back again, there is that dark presence like a serpent lying sleeping. So it never quite goes away. And it's almost as if when we catch ourselves in this moment of dreaming, we're caught between two desperate things, two elemental things. On the one hand, we have this evil. It is evil. It is not good. We hate it. Potter hates it. He hates the river. He's scared of the river. And on the other hand, we have... If you have the book there, you can turn to page 36, I think. That's right. No, it's wrong. There, yeah, 36. Now let me read you, and this is where they begin to take flight. Let me read you how Potter feels. I'll read you a paragraph and a little bit more. You tell me. Don't feel bad if you can't tell me, because it really is obscure, I know that. But it's, I mean, it's just peeping above. It's just a little thing peeping up here. And soon Potter, you tell me, I mean, if you see the illusion in here, literary illusion. And soon Potter, the soul of Potter, lightsome, bright, and glorious, sprang free of his own stiff self. He shook his feathers like metal foil. "Here I am," said Potter the dove. He was breathless, laughing. "All in good time, good Potter," said the oriole, "more beautiful than ever before, golden black and shining. All in good time." Does anybody recognize that?
Hopkins.
Yes, say it loud.
Gerard
Manley Hopkins. Remember the poem? Close, because it's right next to the wind over in here. But it's the same
God's
feeling.
Grandeur
of God. God's grandeur. Listen. Now here's the other side. Here's the other side. And by the way, and then I will place between the two of these something. Listen to this beautiful poem. If we do nothing else tonight, we get to read some wonderful poetry. And those of you who have heard it, no, it's not repetitive. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down in things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and, bright wings. Isn't that lovely? Oh, I love that. It makes me want to cry. There's so much hope and faith in that. And you see, he doesn't look elsewhere for that hope and faith. He looks right here in this created world full of the grandeur of God. And so I just peep up for you. I say, look at this little shook. Here's the line again. He shook his feathers like metal foil. And then I picked the word up, shining, referring to the bird, referring to the oriole. And that whole business of the stretched wings, and you have this sweet, sweet image of the Holy Ghost. Almost, I think it must refer to Jesus Christ's image. How like a hen I would gathers her chicks beneath her wings. And you would not. I think that must be lurking behind there somewhere. But I didn't take the wood knot. So look how that whole poem now becomes the shaper of the story. You see that? The use of the bird imagery. Sense, if you will, I began to have some instinctive sense that the oriole at least represented something of the Holy Spirit flying in and out. Although the oriole was definitely a bird, and I had to use that. But let me pause, and then let me come back to here. The oriole was a bird that I learned something of. This is where the title comes from for the whole book. Henry David Thoreau said of Baltimore Orioles that they sounded as if they said, "Eat it, Potter, eat it." That's exactly what he wrote out. "Eat it, Potter, eat it." And that's where the name Potter comes from. And that's where that whole process of "eat it, Potter, eat it, Potter, eat it, Potter, eat it." That's where I took that from. So, yeah, Holy Ghost, but also a very real bird. And then this idea of issuing out of one's body. Oh, the evangelical Christians were upset with that. They said that's out-of-body experience. They said that feels like, what is it? What is this? What, Mary, where are you? What do they say?
Reincarnation.
Mary went into a bookstore, and they said they probably shouldn't sell it for that reason. And I had to go on Moody Radio and defend this book. We laugh, but people get so... This is what I was talking about with Clara Schreiber. We really need people with flexible minds to understand what kind of creative work that we're doing here. But the idea I didn't make up. It comes from a medieval notion, you know. They used to believe that you would escape your body, that your spirit would literally come out of your body, only they often said in the shape of a mouse.
This is, again, my reading of my history and my understanding, all this profound, wonderful treasure of images that I have of dog line. They would come up and they would say that if the mouse comes out of the mouth, then you better not move the body because the mouse might not find it again and the soul couldn't come home. The soul couldn't come back. I don't ever recall that they used the bird as an image of the soul coming out of the body. They might have, but I did. I chose that for what may happen when the Holy Spirit speaks directly. So on the one hand, it really is a bird. On the other hand, it means all these ways by which God may communicate to us profound and sweet and difficult truths. I suppose it means that. Well, then also from this poem, this wonderful imagery that embraces the entire world. Though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost. And you notice the motion of the entire book, which is east and west. West is toward death. West is back into the reality of living. East is toward the story of the phoenix. Eastward is that shining, and I used that imagery and tried to weave water in at that time. You remember when they fly across the ocean, how the colors change? The first in the early morning, the dawning is a golden color, and then it becomes, what was it next? After golden, I forgot. Oh, here, brassy by the sunlight, and then aluminum at noon. There is this kind of a crossing from where bereavement is and where death is and where danger is to where all those things are gathered up into a whole new perception. Perception that includes resurrection over at this end, which is in the eastward, and that kind of lies behind not just Hopkins, but against general thought that we often have, the east and the west and so forth and so on. And then at the same time, it just occurred that the issue of the water imagery became this crossover thing. To me, it was a wonderful discovery that when Potter eats the mugwort, mugwort, by the way, in old folklore, was that which brought truth to the surface. Eat muggins and may, they used to say, eat muggins and may, to bring also evil things out of yourself or whatever. For me, the wonderful thing was that when I began to describe this coming out of oneself, I wasn't aware at the beginning, but it was almost as though it happened. Oh, the death and the birth imagery. Being born again, almost as baptism, being born, dying and being born, all the stuff that we hear from Scripture about baptism and dying and rising again, was just found its language there at that point. And it seemed to me that I was talking about grief, but I don't say intellectually I understand fully what I'm saying, but it seems to me that there is a connection there, that part of what grieving is this very, very difficult choking unto death, which at the very same time, in the very gesture, is of being born and swinging free, but to return. One more allusion, and you see how all this weaves together. It's at the very, very end, and this is an allusion that didn't surprise me. As the story was being written, I began to sense it. When Potter finally returns, and I'll talk about that return in just a minute too. When Potter finally returns, there is this coughing, and then he's in his body. Coughing and laughing together, the tears filling his eyes and watching the faces of his father and his mother, Potter choked. No, no, he said, but you must love the birds. That was all he could say. Now, these books that I'm reading to you from all come from the library here, and I went to find the book in which that line is, and the book is there, but it's an abridged version, and the line was taken out. I have to tell you myself what it is. It comes from the Brothers Karamazov. It comes from Father Zosima. Father Zosima, shortly before he dies, tells the beautiful Alyosha the story of his own conversion and life. And he had an older brother. It's a wonderful story. It's a beautiful story. And it underlines all this. He had an older brother who was a wild, stinking, sinful brat, violently intelligent. Nobody could control this child. And then this child became sick unto death and went through a period of pre-grieving. Are you here, girl? Pre-grieving. And Mary. And then all of a sudden woke one morning to the singing of the birds. Birds were outside of the window, and he started to cry. He just wept and wept and wept. And I remember, I read this book in high school. And I would have used it, by the way, as one of the shaping books of my life. To read that book shaped me more than I knew. This child wept and then said, "Oh, mother," listening to the birds, "Oh, mother, love the birds. You must love the birds." And it was as though his whole life had turned around to recognize, I'm going to say two things at least, to recognize that all which is the creation of God is lovely and deserving love because it is of the handiwork of God. But it was more than that that this boy was weeping about. The boy's word finally is, and this recurs in Dostoevsky several times, we are responsible for all to all. This deep sense of the communion of all things is what struck that boy, and he heard it in the language of the birds. That also is what underlined this as I was going, that through this entire process, sometimes what comes is an overwhelming, astonishing pity for birds or for creation. And in that pity is a recognition that suddenly we're not in hierarchy, we human beings with the right to have such killing dominion over all other things, but rather that we're in a kind of communion with all things and that we are responsible for all to all. And what Dostoevsky and that child meant at that particular moment was, when somebody else sins, I don't have the right to condemn that sin. I participated in that sin. When somebody else hurts, I'm responsible somehow for that hurt. But this is not a dreadfully heavy message. This is the sweet message of the unity of the universe. Did I just make sense? So for me, and I'm going to have to shut up in a minute, I see how this is timed. So for me, much of the story, you know, I'm studying at the authorities, was to watch Potter grieve. Watch him go through some of these stages that we talked about with Mary this afternoon in grief. Do you think I care? This pushing away, I won't think about it. Do you think I care? Moving from there to anger and feeling scared of the anger. Who are you going to be angry at? And then finally becoming angry at God or angry at self. It's a sick little body, you know, all these. And then becoming terrified of friendships or of any good thing hereafter. Remember how Potter gets scared as soon as the bird talks? Very natural reaction. Because you've already been torn asunder from one whom you love, and so you make this decision in your mind. You say, well, I will protect myself. I will love nobody anymore. And then you have odd, complicated feelings to the lovely people or birds who come up to you. Because on the one hand, you want to love. Do you notice, by the way, that the bird was the only one who I felt did the right thing for consolation for the boy? Here was the mother saying things God took, you know, God took Jonathan. And what was the bird doing out in the... Just crying, just looking, no words. Compasio, sympathos, compasio, suffer with, just suffering with, that's all. So the bird talks, and so all of a sudden Potter is scared. This is such a beautiful and good thing, and Potter backs away. Oh no, he says, but the sweetness of the bird's call. And just the presence and the peace and no argument and no solutions. Death doesn't have a solution. No solution. Just the presence overwhelms this fear until the child finally also loves and goes through. And then, of course, you see the great swings of the child goes back and forth up to when Felix. Isn't that neat, Felix? What does Felix mean?
Happiness.
Yeah. Boy doesn't even know what he's saying. Up to when Felix dies himself. But the structure of this whole thing, I'll allow this to be then my final thought, is this sense that there was death in the family long before there was a death. This was a blocked family. This was a family that was living a dead life because a boy and his father could not communicate. The mother was fully alive. The mother could caress and touch, and yes, she made mistakes about what she said, but she said things. She sat there and she sang and all that consoling beauty. But the father, with these strong arms and the smell of sawdust and so on, couldn't speak love. Remember that block thing? Potter so easily says, "I love you, Poppy." And then a little later on, you see, or at least it seemed to me, that the father was loving that child, saving the child from all the people that were in the kitchen and carrying the child up. But the closest that the father can come to say is, you know what you said before? Me too. Something is broken here. Something is just utterly blocked. And boy, is that Lutheran. Our heritage, we are
are so serious. We are so earnest. We are so sober. We do all things right, Chaz. See? Don't cry. I started crying, really first started crying at Grace Lutheran Church, and then when I had children. I mean, those two things in conjunction. cry for my children and cry. Grace is a black congregation. Much easier to cry. The other day, Dee Dee Lawrence sang such a beautiful song. I just sat there, and it's a wonderful thing. The tears just rolled on my cheeks. I was smiling. It's a beautiful song. But not this man. Not this man. And so, you know, Potter has a decision to make. And I think it is the common decision of the bereaved. At least it felt that way to me. Are you going to return to a place like this? Are you going to return to the West? Are you going to return to the darkness? Are you going to return near the river and endanger yourself? Well, sometimes those who return with the most quivering life, and for whom it is a sacrifice to enter the body again, to enter that life again, are those who have gone through the process of grief. Because now there is in them an empathy as there had not been before. Potter chooses to return. And the crisis forces this strong man with strong forearms, who's always strong in silence, to cry out in a broken way, good breaking in sense. I never had a better child than Potter. I love him. I love him. And see, in my mind, we can't just play resurrection off into the future. I told you that. In my mind, sometimes resurrection is death. It's sacrifice. I sacrifice that we might rise together. Potter's return is something other. That's the urging of the Baltimore Oriole. Though speaking of your mother will be sad. And the father, I am so sorry. What thoughts do you have? What questions? Tape is not yet over. People aren't putting their hands up. Let's start with Stephen.
You let us in on lots of the decisions. How did you decide to write this book? You said you were invited, but you could have turned down that invitation. I mean, you could have written a mystery novel, you could have written another Hemingway, but you chose to write this.
Yeah, it's a good question because, you know, here we're speaking so wonderfully, esoterically, because it was a very pushy editor. I will not say the name, this is going on tape. It was an insistent editor who had been at me for a while already. And because she offered, as she spoke about this and some of the things they hoped to do with this book, it sounded in a very mercantile way, wonderful. And because I had a space of time here, I was between longer, larger projects. I was still at Grace. I was still preaching. This is an easier, I think, essentially. Now, the actual sitting down and the writing of this book took about 3 days, to about 2-3 days for a first complete draft. And so it was easier to do than a complete novel. I think I had finished the Thesaurus at that point. And so it happened at the right time. And then it fell. I was free to choose whatever I wanted. They promised a good illustrator. This is an excellent illustrator. I was able to sit down with Daniel and talk this thing through, all of which felt very good to me. Does that answer?
Yeah.
Is that where your point?
But that's an ethical decision. I mean, one could say, well, gee, if I write this book, somehow my career or prestige or fame as a serious author is endangered.
I mean, because it's published by David Seacole.
Yeah, or that it's a children's book, or that it's a children's film.
Yeah, those things are in one's mind. One does make also business, ethical decisions at the same time. And she was offering some things that felt good. Plus, it gave an opportunity to. The notion of children being excluded from the project, that had been in my mind for a long, long time. And I think perhaps, too, some of those experiences that I referred to at the beginning were kind of clamoring for some shape, some form. Right?
Toward the end of the book, your comment that the comment of the Oriole that he wasn't done with his dying yet. He had to go back and finish his dying.
Yeah.
I like that. That was the paradox of living at the time.
Yeah. Yes, it seemed to me. We almost stand between the deaths, and at least that thought goes through my mind now as I look at it. In our baptism is the beginning of the dying that all together ends when our body dies. And then in between, there's all kinds of little deaths that occur. Yes?
What response have you had from the children?
I'll tell you. Those that I know, good response. Whether or not
they have suffered a death. The book, in fact, gives them the opportunity to do exactly that. And this is part of this business here. You'll notice that the language, even though the language can get very difficult at times, the sentence structure is essentially simple. The best response from little children comes when the book was read aloud to them, which I consider to be very important, and it's a good opportunity for me to say this. When you read aloud to a child, the child has at least two beings present. The immediate being, which is the parent or the friend or the grandma or whatever, which is very, very good companionship because we are together and the other being is the book. And so very often when there is a reading aloud, it doesn't mean you have to explain things. Not at all. It's your very presence which creates community so that you can approach it. I'll tell you what, sometimes too, the children are ahead of the parents. With a book like this, which is not much different from Hans Christian Andersen, The Red Shoes, and other things. If you read The Red Shoes unboldarized, it might scare you. Because a little girl who puts on the red shoes and the shoes begin to dance because she's sinful, she's wearing them when the old lady is dying, the little girl goes to a headsman who cuts off heads in the cottage. And that's what the fellow says, do you know that I axe off heads? And she says, would you cut off my feet? Well, and so parents read something like that, or they say, well, this is too much for children. But very often it isn't because it's within form, because children have the sweet ability of faith. If a story has a beginning and a middle, they anticipate an ending. From the beginning, they anticipate an ending, and they're willing to allow all kinds of experiences its place because they're so willing and easy to trust. I would make the choice as a parent, not upon what is in the story, but what is the ending of the story. What is the ending? Would I read Hansel and Gretel to my children? Yes. Because of the ending. It's a terrible story. Hansel and Gretel talks about abandonment, children being left alone in the woods. It's a very frightening thing for children, more than parents perhaps even know. But in the end, there is this survival, that they overcome the problem, that together, in fact, not Hansel, but Gretel is the one who overcomes the problem by pushing the witch, turning over again. So, in community, very good.
I think this could be an enormously powerful play or movie. How do you feel about that?
Boy, I always like the idea of one genre, at least talking about entering another genre. I like that because I like the collisions of artists' minds, and I like to see what I've done. One of the books I did called Thistle has been turned into a musical play, and I was so happy to see people with skills in music, skills in choreography, skills in drama, take my perceptions and make them their own. It's a marriage, you know. Which means that I marry somebody who's different from what I am, and we have a baby, which is a little bit like both of us, but is neither one of us. I like that idea a lot. Oh, please, I know I left you little time. If you have questions that were lurking in your mind, catch me, and I will sit and I will talk with you. But you are so kind to listen to me talk.